You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 16th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Director of Policy and Government Affairs from the Plowshares Fund, Joel Rubin, on the upcoming negotiations involving Iran's nuclear program. And speaking of nukes, we'll also talk to them about the enormous amount of money we pay for nukes in this country. You know, to make sure that the Soviet Union doesn't attack us, even though they're not the Soviet Union anymore. Also on the program today, Pete Peterson, the billionaire who spent $500 million over the past couple of years to cut your Social Security to make sure that you're not getting too much health care as an old person and they're not living large on those Social Security checks that you will be getting, and the tremendous amount of money that he spends to convince others to convince you that it's no big deal. Surprise, surprise, the mortgage settlement payments not going towards dealing with the mortgage fraud. I don't know if it's a depressing story, but it's a story of just how wrong Antonin Scalia was when he said there's never been evidence that we've ever killed an innocent person in this country via capital punishment. Wrong. And first up, though, some good news. In Rhode Island, Governor Lincoln Chafee Governor Lincoln Chafee, the one-time moderate Republican senator from Rhode Island, is now an independent and, of course, is now governor, has issued an executive order declaring that Rhode Island will recognize out-of-state same-sex marriages. So good for Rhode Island, good for former Republicans. It just goes to show you, the best Republican's always a former Republican. And this is particularly relevant. There's a story out of Miami. A couple, two women, Dana Lafita Smith and Jordan Lafita Smith, who were living in Florida, had been involved with each other for, I think, at least 7 years. And they drove to New York to get married, because in Florida, they're not allowed to. And in New York, same-sex couples have the same rights as non-same-sex couples to marry. And, of course, they understood that their marriage would not be recognized in the state of Florida. But they went back down there, And in Florida, apparently, a marriage certificate is valid ID for Florida's Department of Motor Vehicles. Because it's issued either by Florida or by any other state. Just like you could probably take a driver's license from New York and go and get your car registered in Florida. So Dana and Jordan Lafita Smith went into a Panama City Department of Motor Vehicles office. And they had gotten new Social Security cards with the same last names on the back. They went to get new driver's licenses to reflect that their names have been officially changed. Their last names, anyways. Licenses were printed out. They discovered they were $8 short. And the DMV does not take visas. So they went to an ATM, got the money returned. When they returned, they found out that their licenses had been denied because their marriage certificates were considered invalid because Florida does not recognize same-sex marriage. So contemplate this for a moment. Not only is Florida arguing that we don't give you the same rights as non-same-sex couples, not only do we not recognize your legal contract, essentially, from the state of New York, even though we do generally for non-same-sex couples, we're going to even ignore the validity of this document as being a legitimate document from that state. Never mind that we're not prepared to give you the rights. We just will ignore that document. And the problem is that they can't get a passport. I suppose they could get a passport. Ultimately, I guess they can, but they can't use their Social Security cards because the names are different from their original licenses. Without a license, they can't legally drive. They can't vote. They're at risk of losing their car insurance because the car insurance is... they could lose their car insurance, but they could also lose their car because their loan on their car is a function of having car insurance. And you can't get car insurance if you can't get it registered and get your driver's licenses. Apparently, according to the spokesperson from the DMV, we don't even recognize the documentation of same-sex marriage. And there's a lot of gay people in Florida now who have this problem. But what are you going to do? At least we're not drug testing them like we do everybody else in Florida. It's unbelievable. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Joel Rubin. He is the Director of Policy and Government Affairs at the Plowshares Fund. Let's talk about Iran and their nuclear program, because we know that the... MEK may very well be delisted from its terrorist designation. And we'll ask Joel if he thinks that might be just one more mechanism in which to scuttle a deal. Because we know how desperately we need another war. We're starting to wind down. We've wound down in Iraq. We're contemplating winding down in Afghanistan at least 10 years out. We need another war. I mean... it's been at least a couple of years since we started one. We're going to take a break when we come back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Joel Rubin, he is the Director of Policy and Government Affairs at the Plowshares Fund. Welcome to the program, Joel.
Thank you, Sam, for having me.
So I wasn't even actually, frankly, aware of the negotiations that are going to be taking place with the five permanent members of the UN Security Council next week, and I guess also Germany, in Baghdad, for negotiations with Iran about their nuclear program. And I wanted to get a sense from you how you think those negotiations are going to be handled, and what's the agenda here? Or is this – I mean, I'm a little bit concerned, as I imagine you might be, and most people are, that there's this intense drumbeat for war with Iran, or if not in this country, at least emanating out of the Israeli government. Give me your sense of what's going to take place at those negotiations.
That's right. It's a remarkable moment. Next week, a week from today, the second round of negotiations between the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany as well. They'll be talking with Iran about Iran's nuclear program. And the goal of this is to try to ratchet down the war rhetoric that we've heard that you spoke about, and try to get to a sustainable negotiation process where we can really parse through the difficult issues on Iran's nuclear program and get to some accommodation where we can understand exactly what they're doing, have clear oversight of it, and prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. And it's a good thing these negotiations are ongoing. They're going to be tough. The Iranians are very good negotiators, but it's certainly preferable to war, and is moving in the right direction.
All right. So what give me your sense of what the estimates are. I mean, is there any clear consensus that the Iranians are pursuing the development of a nuclear weapon?
The international community's International Atomic Energy Agency that watches this type of issue, the American intelligence community, the Israeli intelligence community, all agree that Iran has not decided to pursue a nuclear weapon. What they do believe, though, is that Iran is enriching uranium, and Iran has shown that it is to the international community, which, by the way, we currently know how much enriched uranium Iran has. The IAEA, the body that governs the International Atomic Energy Activities, has cameras inside of Iran right now looking at their uranium enrichment. So we know what's going on. They have not decided to build a nuclear weapon. Most estimates argue that if Iran decided to do so, it would take 1 to 3 years for them to acquire a nuclear weapon. So they're a ways off. And it's really important to understand this. And the facts matter. We've been living in a bit of a fact-free zone lately on Iran, and it's good to have that in the mix.
Oh, just lately.
For a lot longer.
Let me. If someone has the bad fortune of stumbling across some right-wing site, and they claim that, well, we don't really know. I mean, how do we know that we know? Not to sound like Donald Rumsfeld.
We know what we know because we have been very assiduous at ensuring that the International Atomic Energy Agency gets into the country. Iran's nuclear negotiators just this week were in Vienna, the headquarters of the IAEA, talking about the next visits to Iran. We have very sophisticated intelligence assets and operations, both on the ground with people as well as in the sky looking at what they have. And they share information with the IAEA on their enrichment levels. Now, that doesn't mean that we should be happy that they're enriching uranium. And it's key to point out that their enrichment is violating international law and UN Security Council resolutions. But we know what they have. And we have the ability to clearly talk to them about it.
All right. So now they are not allowed to enrich uranium, even for civilian purposes, even for developing nuclear power?
this is where the negotiations are heading, and it's a very tangible, practical discussion. Iran asserts it has the right to enrich uranium. It has a nuclear program, ironically, that the United States helped to start in the 1950s in a program called Atoms for Peace. It does have a research reactor for cultivating medical isotopes to help cancer patients in Iran. So, yes, they do have a nuclear civilian nuclear program, and that's generally accepted. The challenge in the UN Security Council resolutions has been about the levels of enrichment. Are they enriching at a civilian usage level of under 5%, or are they going to higher levels that can get into weapons grade? And the UN has called for them to stop that higher level of enrichment, and Iran has not fully complied with that. And as a result, that we're at a point now where they have a modest stockpile of near 20% enriched uranium, not at the level to make a weapon. That would take 90%+, but certainly of concern. And that's where the negotiations are going to really head in the near term, about what to do about that 20%, roughly 20% enriched uranium. And that's something where you can envision a deal, where you can envision an agreement to move that 20% out in exchange for civilian fuel rods that Iran can use that they can't produce right now. So there's some very practical things that we're looking at.
So that's what Iran wants. They want certain technologies that they don't have the ability to develop, but these technologies that they want are for nuclear power.
For nuclear power, for medical research. They're sort of showing the world that they can do it, but they're not doing it in a very efficient or cost-effective way. And they're saying, though, that they have the ability and the skills. They have thousands of nuclear scientists. They have about a dozen nuclear sites. We have supported it historically. The Russians have supported that nuclear infrastructure. They have a program. And so the sooner that the international community moves to accepting that and in return gets the kind of verification and the kind of robust oversight of that program to ensure it's not going to build a nuclear weapon, the better. That's what we need to look at. It's worth saying that a war or an airstrike would do everything to undermine the potential for understanding what Iran's nuclear program is all about. And if we see airstrikes, if we see military action, Iran's nuclear program is going to go underground, and it's certainly going to have an incentive to build a nuclear weapon, something that they currently are not doing.
All right. Well, so in fact, I think it was Rand came out today in their journal and basically said exactly that thing, the Rand Review from the Rand Corporation, said an Israeli or American attack on Iranian nuclear facilities would make it more, not less, likely that the Iranian regime would decide to produce and deploy nuclear weapons. Such an attack would also make it more, not less, difficult to contain Iranian influence. So now, how do we know that they don't already have an underground program? How do we know that I guess if we have the ability now to know what they're doing, how would we lose that ability? Basically, they would just kick the IAEA out, right?
If we were to see a military action take place, they would immediately, kick the IAEA out. Close down the cameras that are looking at the enriched uranium that's stored and essentially make us blind in Iran. But right now, we're not blind in Iran. It doesn't mean it's perfect. There are lots of outstanding questions, and they need to be answered. But the most counterproductive way, and this is coming from across the American national security establishment, and the Rand report reflects that. They very much reflect where the military community is. Intelligence officials, military officials, leaders, here, as well as in Israel, the current head of the Israeli Defense Forces, the current head of the Israeli Mossad, all of them argue against military action. They say they could be counterproductive to what we're trying to achieve, which is to really get Iran's nuclear program under oversight and control so it's used for peaceful and civilian purposes. A military strike would destroy the international coalition of pressure on Iran to do that. It would make us blind. And then, of course, it would be very devastating to the people on the ground in Iran and could really, as well, explode oil prices.
Are you confident that all the players are approaching this in good faith? I mean, the notion of an Iran that has a viable nuclear energy program that they have a civilian, I'm talking about, you know, a better functioning society in some ways, not necessarily in the interest of, or is it, are there forces that would, that want to push this? In other words, you know, just this week, or I guess it was just yesterday, it appears that the State Department, or at least that the U.S. government, has moved a step closer to categorizing the MEK, which is a I don't know, really, it's a group that we have considered long to be a terrorist. They have been sort of anti-Iran, and they've been anti-Iran against their Iranian dissident group, but they've been against multiple regimes. Most people do not consider them in any way a democratic movement, and certainly not activists in Iran. But we are in the process of delisting them as a terrorist organization. And it seems to me that the timing of doing that could very well throw a little bit of a monkey wrench into these negotiations. What's your sense of that?
There are a lot of spoilers out there. Many groups want to see negotiations fail, largely because the state of tension with Iran has been one that's benefited very parochial interests. But it doesn't serve the United States to have a state of tension with Iran. We have a lot of common interests. We are engaged in Afghanistan still. It's important to remember that Iran helped us in Afghanistan in the early days. They're not friendly with the Taliban or al-Qaeda. We have interests in common with them in Iraq. We clearly have oil concerns and natural gas concerns, where they're a main supplier and control a large waterway of the supply route. So there's a lot on the table and a lot of cost if we don't get this under control. But it's very important to point out that living with a nuclear Iran implies that a nuclear Iran is going to have nuclear scientists and nuclear technology. Israel is very concerned about that, and they have a reason to be concerned about Iranian behavior in the region. They've had a long history of conflicts with Iran, but right now in Congress, there's a resolution calling for Iran to not have nuclear capabilities, and that would theoretically mean that they couldn't have nuclear scientists, they couldn't have any nuclear infrastructure, which would basically be impossible to implement without a war. So we're entering into some very dangerous territory. I think the president's hit this right in terms of saying that we need to make sure they don't acquire a nuclear weapon, but we need to engage, and it's going to take time to do this. And while he pushes forward on the negotiations, there can be a lot of sides calling for an end to negotiations because they clearly haven't resolved all the 30-plus years of problems we have with Iran overnight. And we have to be skeptical about that kind of criticism and stay the course.
And yeah, who are those spoilers? I mean, specifically, obviously, there are neoconservative factions in this country. Who else might be considered spoilers?
The region itself right now is entering into a very dynamic phase. And Saudi Arabia, for instance, has been very vocal in its concern about Iran and has been helping to support the pressure on Iran. We've seen Sarkozy as well. In France, he was just voted out. He was one of the leading proponents of a harder position on Iran in the negotiations. That doesn't make them spoilers, and I think they're acting in their own interest. But we have to make sure we identify what our interests are, and our interests are in avoiding another major war in the Middle East, in preventing an Iranian nuclear weapon, and in ultimately changing the direction of the relationship that we have with Iran, because we have many different common interests. But here in Washington, there are people openly arguing for military conflict and airstrikes to resolve this, and that's the last thing we want to do. That would both end our objective of preventing a nuclear weapon and undermine our interests across the region, where we're just getting out from under the heavy burden of ending the Iraq war.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the minimum amount of damage that would do. There's absolutely no evidence that we could actually wipe their program out in any meaningful way, that you know, it's airstrikes or war would be even effective in our limited agenda, never mind the implications of what it could do to the region. But I want to turn also, because you wrote a piece, I guess it was back in December, but it's obviously, you know, across town from you, I think right now, Pete Peterson is arguing that what we really need to do, because of all the deficit hysteria that he has been, in many respects, you know, been paying for, literally, that we need to cut Social Security. And at the same time, we never hear about the amazing amount of money we spend on nukes. I guess presumably because we want to, this to function as a deterrent with the Soviet Union, except for the Soviet Union doesn't seem to be around anymore.
The Soviet Union is gone, but unfortunately, Congress and the nuclear weapons industry hasn't quite noticed that change of strategic landscape. This week, in fact, I think it's going to be released imminently. General James Cartwright, who headed up our nuclear forces and was the number two general to President Obama over the last several years, is coming out with a report to calling for a severe slashing of our nuclear force down to roughly 450 deployed nuclear weapons. Most Americans don't realize that we have 5,000 active nuclear warheads and another 3,000 sitting in storage that were slated to spend hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade. Some estimates have 60 to 70 billion between the nuclear weapons and its related infrastructure annually in expenses for threats that don't exist anymore. And
we have 5,000 active nuclear warheads?
Yes, we do.
How many times over could we blow up the Earth on that? I mean, I'm serious. Like, you know, will 450 nuclear warheads, will that protect us from the Martians that are supposedly coming? Or what? I mean, what, you know, is there even, tell me, you know, just for the sake of argument, what is the argument that we need 5,000 active nuclear warheads? Never mind one.
There's a Cold War mindset that governs this, that more and higher numbers means bigger, better, and stronger, and that you can intimidate your adversary. You'll soon hear, and you're already hearing, that China is the next adversary. China has 200 nuclear weapons, and we, as the argument goes, must have much more than them. Most of the countries with nuclear weapons are our allies, the nuclear club, Britain, France, there's Russia, who we are constantly talking to and negotiating nuclear arms deals with. These are not threats today, but there we are, sitting with an arsenal configured to fight the Soviet Union. A recent study came out that showed that if there was a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, a tense area, and they have nuclear weapons, if they were to unleash 100, it would cause a nuclear winter, a billion people could starve. That's just 100. So you can imagine if you multiply that time and time again. So slashing numbers down to 450 is the least we can do, and certainly is still going to meet the threat threshold that many people talk about.
But what can 5,000 do that 450 can't?
It can. The theory is that it provides complete flexibility on any level against any threat. The triad, as it's known, to deliver these nuclear weapons could be from subs or from air bombers or from ground-based intercontinental ballistic missiles that we could theoretically strike anywhere on the planet in any way possible if we were hit. And that's the rationale. But the guidance and the plan that drives this number of nuclear weapons is currently being discussed right now inside the administration, and it's nearing President Obama's desk to change this type of structure and this kind of guidance that requires us to think about bombing 30 Russian cities. Do we need to bomb 30 Russian cities in order to protect ourselves? No. But that guidance is from the Cold War and still persists today. Over time, and hopefully sooner rather than later, we're going to change that guidance.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems, obviously, it just seems insane. I mean, I get the idea of redundancy. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I get the idea of redundancy. But if the amount of nuclear weapons that are supposedly pointed at us can't even knock out 1/20th, 30th, 40th, 50th of our capacity. The, you know, redundancy gets a little redundant at one point.
Sam, it's part of the broader military-industrial complex, for lack of a better phrase, but it's sort of a self-perpetuating entity that this nuclear weapons infrastructure is, where now you have an infrastructure around the country, you have national laboratories. Just this week, there's a fight in Congress to kill a nuclear weapons production facility in New Mexico, and the Obama administration zeroed it out, and the Republicans in the House have put the money back. That may cost us $6 billion for a facility that no expert says is needed to maintain our stockpile. So there's a continual push to maintain maximum funding for this. And it comes from very conservative lawmakers in general, but it also comes from the bureaucratic inertia of our defense department. So there's a lot of interests here that are pushing back against smart reductions, as you've just described.
Joel, is there a single nuclear program in this country, whether it's civilian or military purpose, whether it's even academic? Is there anybody who is working on nukes in any fashion in this country that somehow is not subsidized by federal dollars?
Well, certainly our foundation, which is aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons and eliminating them, we're not subsidized.
I'm talking about anybody who is actually doing any type of actual sort of scientific research or development of weapons or civilian. I mean, it seems to me there is not, short of people who are trying to curb the amount of money that's being spent on this, it doesn't seem to me possible that there is any individual, you know, even if you're just studying this stuff, it seems impossible, and maybe you can set me straight on this, that your academic department in some way is not getting funded in some measure by federal dollars. I wonder if there isn't a single person in this country who is in any way working with this stuff, you know, and you're talking about it from a policy standpoint, but I'm actually talking about the physical development or the science on it. That isn't getting federal tax dollars.
It would be hard to find one. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars going to the national laboratories who contract out oftentimes or are contracted to universities. There's a lot of commingling there. There's a serious infrastructure amongst the scientific community that is supported by the taxpayer, by you and me, on nuclear spending.
It's just stunning, and that's of course why we see all of these conservatives, these libertarians, all lining up and having these massive protests against this big funding of nuclear weapons and the nuclear industry, is because they cannot stand to see our federal dollars spent in that way.
Well, there is a political fight, though, within the Republican Party right now on national security. The Libertarian wing does see these issues very much from a bottom-line perspective, and they see the waste. And there's the conservative wing, the neoconservatives, that do want to maintain American leadership or hegemony or whatever word you want to use, and want to keep the weapons. And they're fighting it out. Who's going to win is going to be very interesting to see. But really, our budget can't afford this. We have $1 trillion a year in the red. We need to find ways to reduce our expenses. And we don't need to do it on the back of social programs that are already bare bone. We have a lot of waste in this nuclear complex.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind taking some of that $700 billion and actually just rehiring teachers. But I guess hope springs eternal. Joel Rubin from Plowshares Fund, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Sam. It was a pleasure.
All right, folks. Let us move on. It's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. We're actually expanding our nuclear budget relative to what it was under Reagan. And I'm not even talking about accounting for inflation. This is just, it's just insane. And God, if I hear one more word about this from the nightly news or all of these, you know, it's almost impossible to go on a cable television show and not have some libertarian just scream about all the subsidies that we give to nuclear power and nuclear weapons. It's just I can't take it anymore. Wait a second. I'm sorry. I'm confused. I'm thinking about loans to solar companies. Right. Okay, that's what it is. But these people with these solar companies who are developing the solar technology, which could, you know, kill us all if they invent a solar panel that will make the sun explode. Oh, God, so annoying. Let's go into this before we go into the better half of the program. And, folks, I want to tell you something. Pete Peterson, and you know that I have a little concern that we're going to see our Social Security cut very shortly. Maybe it'll happen in the lame duck session. Maybe it'll happen under the Romney administration. Maybe it'll happen under the Obama administration. I think the dice are loaded, so to speak. And I very well may be the only person who talks about politics who's not getting money in some fashion from Pete Peterson. This guy, which is actually another good reason to become a member of the Majority Report, because I get news for you. If I get a phone call from Pete Peterson and he says, Sam, I'm sending over $1.5 million in an unmarked suitcase or something. I don't know. I guess all suitcases are more or less unmarked, but an unbranded suitcase. Because I don't want anything too flashy. No, I don't want $1.5 million worth of cash in some type of Gucci handbag. Because that's embarrassing. Send it over in some type of plain unbranded suitcase. If I get a call from Pete Peterson, and he tells me he's going to do that, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to think long and hard about it, folks. And then the next day, I'm going to come out and I'm going to bring my daughter on the program. And she's going to say something like, I'm not going to have Social Security unless we cut it now to fund tax cuts for millionaires. So I'm just giving you fair warning. If you hear my daughter coming on the program and saying that, good chance Pete Peterson has gotten to me. But you can get to me first. Stave off that Pete Peterson money by becoming a member at Majority.fm. There's other ways to support the show. You know that. But that is the that's where we really need your help. Now, before you think, well, there's no chance of Pete Peterson doing that. Pete Peterson, according to a piece on the Huffington Post by Ryan Grimm and Paul Blumenthal, who incidentally is hosting a fiscal summit, I think he did yesterday, and it's probably a 2-day event. When you're a billionaire, you don't just do one day. Bill Clinton was there. Tim Geithner, his good buddy. John Bonaire was there. Tom Brokaw. Politico's John Harris. I mean, everybody seems to be getting money from Pete Peterson. And if it seems that way, it's because since 2007, between 2007 and 2011, and for those of you conservatives, let me spell this out. That's 4 years. Pete Peterson, personally, himself, contributed at least $458 million to the Pete Peterson Foundation, which is set up to convince you that our government is broke and Social Security must be cut. I'm going to repeat that. $458 million. Let's just call it $500 million, shall we? Over the course of 4 years to convince you that Social Security must be cut.
And why? Because we are in a crisis right now. We're in a total crisis, an unprecedented crisis. There has never, ever been a time where we have had such a fiscal crisis. Never, ever, ever, ever. Though, to be fair, in 1994, Pete Peterson, 1994, said, we will no longer be able to afford a system that equates the last third or more of one's adult life with a publicly subsidized vacation. In other words, we got to cut Social Security as of 1994, he was saying. There are just some people who, ideologically speaking, hate the idea of old people who are getting 80% of their income. 40% of Americans, so retired Americans, get 80% of their income from Social Security. Now, you can do the math. I think the average Social Security payments annually is somewhere around $14,000. So you do the math. He really cannot stand the idea that there are old people living off of $18,000 a year. They're on a paid vacation. These people are going out.